I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Gail Carson Levine, author of Ella Enchanted, on her new book, A Ceiling Made of Eggshells. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Mavena on Israel, Imbal Shtivi. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I've been binge-watching the TV adaptation of Philip Roth's great novel, The Plot Against America, and it's terrific. I think the book is one of his finest, if not his very best. It's set in Newark, New Jersey and Washington, D.C. in 1940 through 1943 or so, and it's a counterfactual, that is, a changed history of how things would have been if they had turned out differently. It is disturbing, relevant, and gripping. In Philip Roth's conception of a dark alternate history, Charles Lindbergh, perhaps the greatest celebrity in the world at the time, famed for his flight over the Atlantic in his airplane, the Spirit of St. Louis, decides to run against Franklin Roosevelt for president in 1940. Lindbergh, a famous isolationist, anti-immigrant xenophobe, and prominent supporter of the America First movement, conducts a whirlwind barnstorming campaign, flying from town to town, and he shocks the world by defeating Roosevelt on a platform of Lindbergh or war. Before long, America has declared strict neutrality in World War II. Lindbergh signs a peace treaty with Hitler, giving Nazi Germany free rein in Europe and limited opposition in Africa and Asia. Soon, back home, an American version of fascism is being implemented, and Jews are among the first to be targeted. The story is told from the perspective of a working-class Jewish family in Newark who experiences the changes in their world in increasingly dangerous ways. The old idea that it can't happen here, meaning fascism in America, is challenged and then proven wrong. Roth draws a very believable version of America in the early 1940s, a country so intent on staying out of another European war, it is unwilling to fight the horrible evils of fascism and dictatorship in the name of democracy. The TV series brilliantly shows an America more concerned with the potential dangers of immigrants and communism than the criminal brutality and maniacal viciousness of authoritarian regimes and racism. It is a stunning show with outstanding acting by all the principals, especially Zoe Kazan as the mother, and Winona Ryder, who is Jewish, shows up as her sister who marries a rabbi who is quickly co-opted into Lindbergh's sphere. The child and adolescent actors are terrific, and all of the leads are excellent, as is the direction. The tension builds so beautifully in the book, and it does much the same in the film series, or I guess it's TV series. The fact that much of the show was filmed near Jersey City, sight of the vicious anti-Semitic killing just a few months ago, brings added poignancy to the dramatic, dark story. You know, I always wondered why nobody had made a movie out of this book of Philip Roth's. Instead, movie makers focused on far less cinematic vehicles like American Pastoral, Indignation, and The Dying Animal. The Plot Against America always seemed to me to be a much more visual and well-plotted story than any of these. But perhaps this outstanding series is why nobody made a movie until now. Because, for the first time now in a very long while, during a period of the resurgence of anti-Semitism on many levels in America, we Jews have some reason to believe that actual fascism could be established here. I recommend watching The Plot Against America during your shelter-in-place time at home this spring. It will not help you to sleep better at night, but it might help you wake up to the deep danger that fascist, authoritarian regimes pose to American democracy, well, to all democracy, which safeguards religious freedom here. If we can learn this lesson, we can protect our nation from authoritarian solutions that destroy so much without building anything good. On a lighter note, and to play us in this morning, here's an Ahavat Olam by the Platt Brothers. Tony Award winner Ben Platt and his brothers Jonah and Henry Platt singing their arrangement of Ahavat Olam, the evening prayer about God's eternal love for our people, giving us Torah and mitzvot. They recorded it in their music room, or somewhere in their house anyway, on an iPhone last week during this pandemic period. Ahavat Olam, Beit Yisrael, Amcha Ahavta, Torah u'mitzvot, Chukim u'mishpatim, Otanu limadeta. Ahavat Olam, Beit Yisrael, Amcha Ahavta, Torah u'mitzvot, Chukim u'mishpatim, Otanu limadeta. That was Ahavat Olam, a YouTube performance by the Platt Brothers recorded last week during this lockdown. When we come back in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Gail Carson Levine, author of the young adult classic book Ella Enchanted, will tell us why she chose a thoroughly Jewish theme for her new book, which has kings, queens, and princesses, but they aren't the main characters. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothill, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events, even during this spring pandemic period. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. a new progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson in the foothills. Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times, and in these days of coronavirus tsoras, join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Shabbat services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, and we will be holding services with full music by virtual experience every week. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom, which you can access by emailing us at www.beitsimchatucson.org. Our synagogue's at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance of the Foothills Mall, not in the mall, but on the south side in our own building. But for now, we are a fully functioning virtual congregation on Zoom and Facebook. Please email me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson, to get more information. Find out about Beit Simcha to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, all on Zoom, and of course our services on Facebook. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing Jewish synagogue in all of Arizona during its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Gail Carson Levine is the, I don't know, can we call you a distinguished author now with all the books that you have written?
Yes, certainly. That
okay,
would be great.
Good. Very distinguished. A Newbery Honor Award-winning author of Ella Enchanted and many other novels and young adult books and kids' books. She has a new book out called A Ceiling Made of Eggshells. With a deep and fascinating Jewish history. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be talking with you.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Tell us a little bit about the origin of A Ceiling Made of Eggshells and a little about your Thessaloniki or Salonika background.
My father was Sephardic and was born in Salonika and came to the United States when he was very, very young. He his first language was, I don't know if it was Ladino or Spanish. And uncle definitively told me it was Spanish, but I'm not sure. And he became an orphan very early on, grew up in an Ashkenazi orphanage, and lost touch with his roots, lost his Spanish. All his other relatives were polyglots, but he lost that connection. And he didn't talk about his childhood, which I think was very tough. So the absence of knowledge, I think, has always made me curious. And he was descended from Jews because Sephardic Jews are Jews who were expelled from Iberia. And the Jews who were expelled from Spain were expelled in 1492. And so I became fascinated with history and started reading and became more fascinated. I've written the book. The book is about to come out, and I'm still reading because I just can't let go of it. I keep being astonished and astonished again and astonished again. And to give an example of some of the things that astonished me, and they're not great things. And the first, I just had to read from several sources before I understood it, is that the Jews in Spain, and I believe in medieval Europe, although they were kicked out of most of medieval Europe before they were kicked out of Spain, were considered the possessions of the monarchs. And it was slavery, but a strange kind of slavery, because they could move around and they could choose their own occupations. But their fealty, they weren't serfs, but their loyalty was directly to the monarchs. And sometimes in medieval Spain, if a Jew was injured or killed, compensation did not go to the family. Compensation went to the king or queen, because the loss was considered to have been the king or queen's loss, because the king or queen lost the value of their labor. It's just astonishing. And another example of being astonished was that priests and monks would invade synagogues during worship and harangue congregants about hellfire and conversion. So that was the world that I entered and still can't leave.
It's fascinating stuff, and it makes for a charming, interesting, and fascinating book. We will talk much more with Gail Carson Levine. We'll return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Cohen Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen and Irma Cohen, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Cohen Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Cohen Foundation Award, please go to CohenAward.com, CohenAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is CohenAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or ikvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, TooJewishRadio.com, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Over the course of this part of the Omer, we have been discussing that kind of important Jewish concept. We bless God at good, we bless God when bad things happen. Let's explore that a little bit. You know, obviously terrible things happen. Terrible things have happened quite recently. What's the best way for human beings to respond within the context of Jewish tradition?
Well, even when you learn about the death of a loved one, what do you say?
Baruch Dayan Emet. Blessed is God, the true judge.
Right? Right. So you're blessing God for some tragedy in your life, the loss of someone who may have been very important to you. And you're still finding a reason to bless God. So the assumption is that ultimately God is both just and good. And
sometimes we don't understand, right?
Right. We don't know the long game. And sometimes you suffer what appears to be a terrible fate in order to spare you from a much worse fate. So I think that Judaism is fundamentally an optimistic religion. People portray the God of the Old Testament, the God of the Jews, as stern and angry and this, that, and the other thing. But in fact, our core belief is that he's all-merciful, treats us with loving kindness.
El chanun v'rachum, erech apayim v'rav chesed v'emet. Right, long-suffering, abundant in kindness.
Right. And that sometimes when bad things happen, it's a wake-up call. We just recently celebrated Pesach, and we talked about the 10 plagues in Egypt. So even those plagues, they affected a lot of innocent people, but they didn't start off so badly. And each one God was giving the Egyptian leadership a chance to say, go, let my people go. And only when they refused did he send a worse plague and a worse plague and a worse plague until he arrived at killing the firstborn in every Egyptian family. And that was the one that was so bad that the Egyptians changed their ways. So there was, it wasn't like capricious cruelty. It was, there was a purpose. And if we see history as the story of God's revealing his intentions for humankind, then we bless him for both the good and the bad.
You know, it's obviously easier to praise God when things are good. And maybe the book of Job is the greatest illustration of that. Everything goes wrong. And, you know, Job's wife says, curse God and die, like just get it over with. And Job refuses to do so. I praised God when things were great. I'm going to praise God now when things are horrible. It's a challenge in many ways for those of us so constituted to like the good better than the evil, which is most of us. But it's, I think it's a foundational understanding that allows us to remain balanced and to understand that what we experience, we don't get to control what we experience. All we can control is our own responses to it.
Right.
Tom, thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi Na, our expert on Israel, Inbal Shtivi, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Inbal.
Boker Tov.
So finally, Israel has a government, an official one.
Finally is the key word here, I think. Yeah, so finally we have a government. It was not sworn in yet, but it will probably soon, unless something happens. It took more than a year and three rounds of elections to get to a point where a government is proposed even, which is in itself an achievement in a way, to get to that point after such excruciating, I would even say, political process. Yeah, that's the situation. We have a government, probably. It's not sworn in yet. On the other hand, some people, you know, kind of are saying this is a government that is not either not going to last for long or for the, because of the differences between the parties inside and because of political tensions from outside the government. And some people even say that the bond itself between the two major parties, which is Chosen Israel, Chosen Israel is a part of Kahol Levan. It's not like blue and white got into the government in one piece. They changed. They only, I would say, half of it got into a dialogue with Netanyahu, while the other half is very critical about this process, extremely critical about this process. So, you know, the future...
Well, look, I mean, there were plenty of people in Kahol Levan who did not want to have anything whatsoever to do with Bibi Netanyahu.
Right. Many people who voted for this party voted for it because of that. That's the...
Yeah, because they thought it would be a change from Netanyahu.
Right. On the other hand, the situation in Israel necessitates some compromise. You cannot be so, that's another opinion, right? It's not, maybe not, another opinion is that the situation with the COVID-19, with the financial crisis that is going on, with everything, some people say, okay, we cannot be so picky, right? That's another opinion. But altogether, I can say that having a government that has the authority to make those decisions and to manage this this present, this crisis, this situation, is better than having a transition government. But because what was there? What is there now at the moment when we speak? At the moment, we have a transition government. This is not an elected...
Well, it's not an elected majority, that's for sure, or even a majority
coalition.
No,
it's not even about majority or minority.
Right.
It's about a transition government. In Israel, when in the time between the election and the swearing in a government, it's called a transition government. And a transition government, historically and usually, doesn't have the mandate, the capacity, the moral authority to take dramatic decisions. Of course, reality always, you know, laughs in our face. COVID-19 came just inside our own democratic process.
Right. I think a lot of people feel finally there's a government. We don't have to have another fourth election in a little more than a year. And it's not perfect, but it's something permanent or semi-permanent anyway.
Yeah, many people do say that. Many people say, listen, whatever it is, we can agree, we cannot agree. From either side of the political spectrum, by the way. Some people think that Gantz is a terrible lefty, if you're looking at it from the extreme right. And some people on the left or the center are saying, how can you sit with this and that, right?
Right, right,
but
of course.
Overall, there is also the notion that we say, okay, there's a global crisis, there's a national crisis, there's a financial crisis. Someone needs to be there, and we have to kind of have a government one way or the other.
That's one of the perspectives. Yeah, I think I might agree with that, especially after all this time. Thanks so much, Inbal. Yeah. We will talk next week.
Later. Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. This week on special, two very old Jewish jokes. Two old men, acquaintances, but not really friends, sit on a park bench. One of them turns to the other and says, remind me, was it you or your brother who died last winter? That joke, by the way, is at least 1,700 years old. An older couple is having dinner with their friends. When the women go into the kitchen, the two husbands, Abe and Mo, sit at the dining room table. Abe mentions a great new restaurant and his wife just discovered. What's the name of it? Mo asks. Dang, I'm blanking here. Help me out, Abe says. What's the name of that red flower? A poppy? No, the other one. A tulip? No, you know, the one with thorns. A rose. Thanks, Abe says. He turns to the kitchen and yells, Rose, what's the name of that restaurant? Those were the old Jewish jokes of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live, and please be well. And now a word of Torah. Emor, our portion this week in Leviticus, begins as so many others do. God gives commands to the people of Israel, but the language this time is a little different. Usually, commandments begin with the Hebrew word daber, speak to the children of Israel, or occasionally tzav, command the children of Israel. This time, a much softer word, emor, say to the priests, the children of Aaron, is used. Why? There's a clue in the continuation of the first sentence of our portion. The Seder actually begins, say to the priests, and then adds, and say to them. As the commentators do not believe the Torah is ever truly redundant, the Talmud teaches there is a subtle message here. Be cautious in how we adults speak to children. Emor means speak softly and kindly. Good advice in instructing children at any time. But why specifically is this word emor used twice in regard to the priestly commands? The priests, after all, are not children. Perhaps the essence lies in the central message of holiness given to our ancestors and articulated forcefully at the start of last week's portion of Kedoshim. You shall be holy, for I, God, am holy. Here in Emor, as the specifics of the designated representatives of the people in holiness are articulated, the change to softer language is notable. The priests are the ones who actually have to help the people achieve holiness. They must be given the careful, scrupulous requirements, but also inspired to do that work with devotion and passion. There will be a balance to maintain between conscientious, obsessive attention to detail and finding a way to communicate the sacredness of their calling to the Jewish people, who are not as occupied with its processes and may not be as emotionally invested in it as they are. Thus the word used here in Emor, speak, explain, teach, and inspire, not simply daber, tell, command, order, require. In leading anyone towards holiness, there must be a serious, conscientious devotion to quality. Badly performed rituals inspire no one, but there must also be a demonstrated process of caring about the way those processes are experienced by the devotees, even perhaps, especially, a love for both the process and the result. This week of Emor, may we be inspired to seriously and caringly seek holiness in our lives through our Jewish practice, and seek to inspire others to do so as well. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Gail Carson Levine, author of a young adult classic, Ella Enchanted, explains why her new book, A Ceiling Made of Eggshells, is called that, and why it's so very Jewish and important. Find out when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
New York's Mayor Bill de Blasio sparked controversy last week after he broke up crowds gathering for a rabbi's funeral and threatened arrests, with religious leaders accusing him of unfairly targeting the Jewish community. Thousands of Orthodox Hasidic Jews, according to the mayor's estimate, lined the streets of the Williamsburg area, Brooklyn, late last Tuesday to pay their respects to 73-year-old Rabbi Chaim Mertz, who died from COVID-19. Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York took to Twitter to describe how he personally forced the mourners to disperse, saying there was zero tolerance for large events while the city fights coronavirus. My message to the Jewish community and all communities is this simple. The time for warnings has passed, he wrote. I have instructed the NYPD to proceed immediately to summon or even arrest those who gather in large groups. This is about stopping this disease and saving lives, period. De Blasio was slammed for specifically mentioning the Jewish community and for appealing to lump all Jews of this diverse faith together when it was only some members of one sect in attendance. I saw the troubling photos from the funeral, but singling out the entire Jewish community for possible arrest sends a shiver down our collective spine, tweeted Ted Deutsch, chairman of the House of Representatives Ethics Committee. Mr. Mayor, when you've got a message for all communities, we Jews are covered. De Blasio apologized if his choice of words offended anyone, but doubled down on denouncing the gathering. I have no regrets about calling out this danger, he said, adding he would deal very, very aggressively with social distancing violations. Social media users pointed out that large groups of people had also gathered the day before to watch U.S. military fighter jets fly over New York, in a tribute to coronavirus healthcare staff. The Orthodox Jewish Public Affairs Council tweeted photos of crowds watching the planes. At New York City, Mayor BDB was wrong to rush to Williamsburg for a thing, lack of social distancing, that has gone on all day across the city, and he was wrong for his tweet, they said. He accused de Blasio of singling out all of New York City's 1.1 million Jews, the largest Jewish community outside of Israel, largest Jewish city in the world, in fact, when a few hundred, mostly teens, had attended the funeral. The headquarters for the Satmar Hasidic group wrote that the funeral had been held with the approval of New York police, who brought barriers to help block off the street. NYPD Commissioner Dermot Shea said local police officers were in contact with members about the gathering, but did not say whether any authorization had been given. Plans in advance for an outdoor funeral for Rabbi Chaim Mertz included social distancing and masks for everyone. Unfortunately, this didn't pan out, and NYPD had to disperse the crowds, he said. We shall note that everyone followed the police officers' orders. The vast majority did wear masks. Yet the confusion and chaos led to scenes of large, mixed crowds. We understand Mayor Bill de Blasio's frustration and his speaking out against the gathering, As said, we thought the procession would be in accordance with the rules. We apologize that it turned out otherwise. The evening funeral, which is organized hastily in accordance with Jewish law, was publicized in a poster made by the rabbi's synagogue, Tolat Yaakov. That poster included a map of the funeral route on Bedford Avenue in Williamsburg, advising mourners anyone attending the funeral must wear a mask and stay 6 feet apart from others. The directive to wear masks was repeated by the Williamsburg Shomrim, a local patrol group run by Hasidic Jews, though videos from the scene clearly show many people without masks and within the prescribed 6 feet. Everyone on the street should have a mask, a Shomrim member said in a video circulated before the funeral, but photos show crowds gathered close together and some people not wearing masks. De Blasio has faced a great deal of criticism in the aftermath. A formal letter of complaint came from New York Congressman Gerald Nadler, among others. Tweets complained about his comments. They came from people like Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL. In truth, the sole reason for complaint, I see, is that de Blasio specifically mentioned the Jewish community, instead of simply saying no gatherings of any New Yorkers without practicing social distancing would be tolerated. The over 1 million Jews in New York City certainly cannot be said to act with any degree of uniformity on virtually any subject, and I cannot imagine non-Hasidic ultra-Orthodox Jews gathering in such numbers at this time for any rabbi's funeral, no matter how prominent. In Israel, some coronavirus restrictions are being lifted, but very carefully and not everywhere. For example, the ultra-Orthodox city of B'nai Brak, which has been a hot spot of the country's coronavirus outbreak, says it will not be reopening schools yet. This is even after Israel's health ministry recommended allowing grades 1 through 3 to return to school. Classes are split into groups of no more than 15 each. The health ministry also recommends Israeli kindergartens reopen a week or two later. It is considered more difficult to ensure that younger children maintain social distancing, no kidding, which raises the risk of infection. Even when kindergartens do reopen in Israel, the ministry suggests they be divided into groups of no more than 8. There have been about 1,000 coronavirus cases in children younger than 9 in Israel, another 2,000 in children older than 9. Another ultra-Orthodox neighborhood in Jerusalem, Romema, was also locked down, as it now qualifies as a hotspot for COVID-19 infection.
Ein Kelohenu. It's a joyous song. It's a prayer about praising the Lord, telling the Lord how much we love him or her. But no matter what I do, I can't seem to be able to get you folks to sing it with any feeling. I mean, I brought in the band. That didn't work. I brought in my bongos last week. I think we can all agree that was a backward step. So this morning, I've decided to bring in a little outside help. Maury, if you would. You can even sing along. Come on, have a little fun with it. That's right, get up, get those putts out of the chairs. Come on. Up in the cheap seats. I can't hear you up there. Sing it out. Come on. Over 70. Come on, all the young Jews.
The movie Keeping the Faith, starring Ben Stiller and Edward Norton, was released 20 years ago this week. You know, it may not be a great movie, but it's a charming romantic comedy, a rom-com, about a romantic triangle between two best friends, a young Catholic priest, played by Edward Norton, and a young assistant rabbi, played by Ben Stiller, who are both in love with the same woman, played by Jenna Elfman. When a friend of mine from rabbinical school first told me about the movie way back in 2000, I thought, what a ridiculous premise. A rabbi and a priest in love with the same shiksa? This is going to be terrible. But at my rabbinical friend's recommendation, I went to see it. And early in the movie, Ben Stiller, playing the young rabbi, starts Shabbat services and urges people to say Shabbat Shalom, only to get an apathetic response. He then says something like, My mom is the only one giving the approximate level of Shabbat shalominess we require. Let's try that again. I sunk deep into my movie theater seat, thinking, oh my goodness, that's me up there on the screen. I do almost that every week. And when the priest, played by Edward Norton, says about himself and Ben Stiller's rabbi character, we were going to bring our religion into the 21st century any way we could, even if we had to shove it there against its will, I could certainly relate to my work as a then-young rabbi. Keeping the faith also showed rabbis and priests as fully human beings with actual normal feelings, desires, goals, relationships, and energy. You know, it's not a classic film, but if you haven't seen it, now is a great time to watch it on Netflix or Amazon Prime or YouTube or whatever streaming service is keeping you sane during this lockdown. It's a truer representation of the reality of being a young guy deeply committed to God and his religion, figuring out how to invigorate that tradition and try to live a semi-normal life in a complicated contemporary world. It's 20 years old, but the challenges and conflicts and humor it presents are still valid and often very funny. Highly recommended. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Gail Carson Levine, is the author of a number of novels. Her first novel, her very first novel, Ella Enchanted, won a Newbery Honor, was later made into a movie, shall we say, loosely based on the book. She has a new book out based on her coming from her Sephardic heritage called A Ceiling Made of Eggshells. It's terrific, highly recommended. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. Tell us where the title of the book came from.
Well, thank you for the kind words. The title, I read a myth about King Solomon, and he wanted to marry a young lady, and she refused to marry him unless he built for her a ceiling made of eggshells. And I was so charmed with that, I put it into the book. And then I was casting around for a title, and that's often very stressful. And the phrase came back to me. And often when I come up with titles, either my editor hates them or the marketing people hate them, and it's a headbanger. But this one she liked right away. She asked me to kind of punch up the significance in the book, and I did that easily with a metaphor by saying that the Jews of Spain were as surprising and as fragile as a ceiling made of eggshells. And I also love the title because it sets the book apart from all my other books, and many of them are fantasies and have fantastical titles. And this one, I think, just hits the mark.
So, and you did a tremendous amount of research, and you start off, well, I don't want to give away the whole plot, but your protagonist is sort of well ensconced among the elite of Spain, and then, of course, things change. Can you tell us how she evolved for you?
Well, one of the first things that I had to think about was that, and the more I read, the more I realized how problematic it was, that a girl at that time would have very little agency. And people in general had little agency. And generally, you followed, if you were a man, you followed the occupation of your father. If you were a girl or a woman, you stayed home. You went to the synagogue on holidays. You didn't go on the Sabbath, generally. You cooked. You cleaned, you took care of younger siblings. If you were a child, you married early. And your life followed a pattern that was established. But I had to write about somebody who had some agency. And so I put her in this family of wealthy family. The patriarch of the family is a courtier and a financier and also a philosopher. And I read a a biography of Isaac Abravanel, whom people may be familiar with.
The famous Jewish scholar, author, mystic, and highly influential guy in the Spanish Jewish community. Please continue.
Yeah, and there weren't many. By that time, the Jewish community in Spain had been impoverished, and the tradition of courtiers was much reduced, but there were a few left. And so from this biography that I read, I kind of plotted out his life and where he went, and he becomes very attached to his granddaughter, my imagined character, loosely based on Isaac Abravanel. After the death of his wife, he becomes very attached to her, and he brings her along with him on his travels across Spain. And I also gave him a disease. He's subject to spells, which are, in modern terms, minor strokes. And so when he has them, and his granddaughter is alone with him, and some servants, she has to act. And gradually she begins to gain agency. And this is not what she wants. She loves the tradition. She wants to be a wife and a mother. She wants to be home, cooking. She loves children. She wants to take care of her nieces and her nephews and her younger siblings. And that's denied her by this life, which she also sees the charm of and the value. And she's aware of how lucky she is. And she adores her grandfather. So she's kind of in tension throughout the story. But her travels make it possible for her to see what's going on. And so she experiences Spain on the cusp of this terrible time.
You know, I was fascinated by some of the, I don't want to say medieval, but early modern science involved, the navigation that you talk about. You must have done a great deal of research to pull that up.
Well, I read about Abraham Zacuto and his almanac that Columbus relied on. And then I wrote a whole 50 pages about the voyage to the Kingdom of Naples, which my editor said was too depressing because terrible things happen. And so I reduced it to a few paragraphs. But I learned a lot about seafare through the 50 pages on the cutting room floor.
How much do you write that doesn't end up in your books usually?
Always. Hundreds of pages. I'm not a fast writer, and I am resigned to going down blind alleys and finding my way out of them. And also, I like to think that my prose is pretty concise. So my revision process, a great deal of it is cut, 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 and it gets better.
Coming back to the book, Sailing Made of Eggshells, you really get a sense throughout the book of the sort of growing crisis for the Jews of Spain, the persecution, the ransoms paid to save populations, the gradually tightening noose. How was that to write about? I mean, it's not cheerful stuff, right? And, you know, you're used to writing fantasy stuff and there's drama and it builds to a climax, but usually there's a happy ending, no?
Well, there are a couple of things that helped. As I wrote, Loma, my main character, became for me my ancestor. And I'm here. And so there was that. There was that thread of hope to cling to, because I have to know my ending when I start writing. So I knew I knew that I was here. So if she was my ancestor, she had to make it out, even though dreadful things happen. And then, you know, I'm very much in the world of the 21st century, and while I was writing it, I kept thinking, gee, I may not be so happy about what's going on today, but the 15th century was so much worse. So there was that happy contrast that I could hold with me. I'm not, you know, today we're in such trying, terrifying times that the difference becomes less. But then it was a little better, so that helped. And the other part was that I was learning so much, and that was so gratifying that, you know, and it wasn't all miserable. You know, one of the books that I read was about Queen Isabella, and she had quite a sense of humor. She rewarded a messenger for messing up because she predicted that he would. So when he messed up, according to her, she was happy about it. So there were, like, astonishing things that just happened along that cheered me up.
You note in the introduction that this is the second book inspired by the life of your father, this one going, of course, deep into a background that of his family, the other one kind of more focused on his life. Are there more books to come inspired by your Jewish family?
I would like there to be. So I am, I keep reading. That's one of the reasons that I keep reading. And I've just started a book about a family history of a very influential family in from Salonika and a blended Ashkenazi Sephardic family in the 20th century. And it's the history of Sephardim in the 20th century through this family. So I don't know. That book may give me ideas. I just read a very strange...
By the way, the author of that book was just on this show, so keep
going.
Oh,
my goodness. I've just started it. I think
it's
her writing
great. It's a wonderful... She's a terrific writer, a historian from UCLA. She's great.
Yeah.
So continue, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I just read, I don't know if I can use this, a very, very strange monograph about the wife of the false messiah,
Sabbatai. Yes.
So
fantastic, weird, and difficult story.
Yes, yes. So I'm interested, right now I'm writing a book about the Trojan War. But while I'm working on that, I'm continuing to read this history. And I hope that
Sarah Stein's book you're talking about, Family Papers. She was delightful. She's a great guest. Not any better than you, though, Gail.
Oh, my goodness.
I want to thank Gail Carson-Levine for a terrific visit here on Too Jewish. The book, well, it's young adult fiction, is, I think, wonderful for anybody. It's called The Ceiling Made of Eggshells. Anybody interested in Sephardic Jewish history, or just a great story. Where can people go to find out more about you, more about your work?
My website is GailCarsonLevine.com, and there's stuff about the book there.
Gail, thank you so much, and let's talk after your next book comes out, if that's okay.
I would love that.
Thanks so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be our good friend Sam Glazer, discussing the best Jewish ways to survive quarantine, lockdown, and social distancing in the time of pandemic. Our playout this morning comes from the recent 90th birthday tribute to Stephen Sondheim, a virtual celebration of the genius composer of Broadway. Mazel tov to Sondheim, another Jewish great of the American musical stage, on his 90th birthday. My friends, may you have a healthy week, God willing, a Shavua Tov, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, midair. Send in the clowns.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.